You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Rising rents, low vacancy rates, and a hot rental market. Sound familiar? Well, although today's renters don't have it easy, a tight real estate market from 1917 to 1929 and exorbitant rent increases over those 12 years pitted New York's landlords and tenants against each other. It led to contentious rent strikes and got the state and federal governments involved, giving rise to rent control. MIT Urban Studies professor Robert M. Fogelson tells that story in his latest book, The Great Rent Wars, New York, 1917-1929. It's published by Yale University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Fogelson back to our show today. Hello.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, the rent control that most of us are familiar with didn't start in New York until 1943. Did it have its roots in the rent wars of the 10s and 20s?
Not really. Before I started this book, I had assumed, like most everyone, including most urban historians, that rent control came for the first time to New York during World War II, a result of the OPA's effort to control inflation. It was only when I was doing research for a book about the history of downtown, with which I spoke with you, 12 years ago. That I was studying the origins of urban redevelopment, and I came across this rash of rent strikes in New York, in which tens, hundreds of thousands of tenants participated. And it seemed interesting to me, and I started to look into these rent strikes, and I discovered that one of the principal consequences was that the state legislature imposed rent control in New York City in 1920 in two sets of laws, the April laws and the September laws, all told about 20 of them. And it was a big surprise because we think of it as a very conservative period of time. And the rent control laws were passed by a legislature that was dominated by upstate Republicans, most of them quite conservative. And at some point, I decided that this would be the subject for my next book.
But they had a limited duration, didn't they?
Yes, they were called emergency rent laws. And the most important of them only ran for 2 years.
Now, they were driven by the same thing that led to the next rent control laws, and that was inflation. As I understand it, in 1916, over 40% of all of the city's apartments had been built since 1903. So there was a real building boom, wasn't there?
Tremendous boom in the decade and a half before World War I. But then construction comes to a standstill from 1917 until about 1922.
Well, how did the building boom and the high vacancy rate that it created affect the relationship between tenants and landlords?
Well, for one of the few times in New York history, it was the landlords were at a disadvantage. There were more apartments. The rents were kept down. Landlords were offering concessions, paying moving expenses to get and keep tenants. And that continues. The landlords claim they're not making any money. Some of them say that they're having to watch their property foreclosed by the banks. And then suddenly, not so suddenly, but starting during the Second World War, there's a shortage of labor, of
the
materials.
First World War,
and capital, and building stops. And suddenly the vacancy rates just plummets. At some point it hits less than 1%, and the landlords start jacking up the rent.
Well, they had appealed to some very low-income people who were eager to move out of squalid tenements throughout the city when the rents were low. Now suddenly they have tenants they would prefer not to have.
Well, they're not unhappy with the current tenants. They're very unhappy with the rents they've been getting. And starting in 17, 18, 19, 20, the rents start going up. And since most tenants, for one reason or another, are monthly tenants, without written leases, under the law, the landlords are allowed to raise the rent whenever they see fit, and they do so.
Was there hope that with the end of the war in November 1918 that construction would start up again?
Absolutely. I write about this at some length. They assumed that everything there would be – labor would be plentiful after the war, supplies plentiful, and there'd be plenty of capital. It turns out not to happen. The construction doesn't begin after the war, partly because everyone expects a big deflation to occur. And if you start to build now at what are still inflated rates and then all the prices go down, you'll be stuck with property that you can't afford.
Well, the deflation didn't come for another 10 years or so.
No, the deflation did not come.
Until the Great Depression.
Yeah.
You write that in 1920, of the 1 million apartments in the city, only 3,500 were vacant. How many people would apply for a single vacant apartment?
There were cases where the landlord simply stopped taking waiting lists because they could rent almost anything, and they did because there was almost no place to move.
Well, I can't imagine. Today it's a rather tight rental market, but I can't imagine it's anything like that.
Nothing is.
Do we know how it compares?
I don't know. There are others who would know, but it drops well below 1% and especially very low in Manhattan, Bronx, and Brooklyn, where the rent strikes are most heated.
Well, I would assume that most of the vacant apartments were from the old tenements on the Lower East Side and other places that were considered almost uninhabitable. But people were still living in them?
People were still living in them. Some have been destroyed to make way for parks and schools and approaches to bridges. But it's also true that the New Law tenements, the post-1901 tenements, the vacancy rate is virtually zero in those as well.
Was the city enforcing sanitary and building laws in those places?
Not very effectively. There were several reasons. One is that there were never enough inspectors. Tammany Hall tends to control the whole process. And also, when the housing crunch becomes so severe, if you start enforcing them and the tenants don't fix the houses, you can condemn them, but then the tenants are on the street.
My guest is Robert M. Fogelson. His latest book, The Great Rent Wars, New York, 1917-1929. This is also a time of an influx of immigrants, isn't it? So does that make the situation worse?
No, the influx of immigrants had slowed during World War I, and it was not as heavy as it had been in the 1890s and early 20th century. That doesn't work, but the population of New York is still growing. But when the residential construction comes to a standstill, you have even more people competing for the few available apartments.
Were other American cities having similar housing issues?
Yes, many others, the most important of which was Washington, D.C. As I point out in the book, Congress imposed rent control under what was known as the Ball Rent Act in 1919. And unlike New York, that covered commercial property as well as residential property. It was very, very controversial. It lasted 6 years until it was decided by the courts that the emergency in Washington, D.C. was over. And under the Supreme Court ruling in the New York case and in a Washington case of 1921, the U.S. Supreme Court held that these laws were valid only in the event that there was still an emergency.
Is that something that has come up later in the fights over rent control and rent stabilization?
I can't speak well to that. I assume that the decision, the Brown v. Feldman, is still in place, and it's based on the existence of an emergency. What New Yorkers then have to do from 1922, in November, when the laws were supposed to expire, until 1929, June, when they do expire, was to figure out whether there's still an emergency. Because if there's no emergency, the laws are no longer valid. So Governor Smith sets up a commission of state of housing and regional planning, and it holds, over time, two long hearings. They run 2,000-plus pages, in which Clarence Stein, the architect and planner, and the other members of the commission try to figure out, is there still an emergency?
Well, you start the book with a coal shortage in New York that began in earnest in January 1918, 8 months after the United States had entered World War I. Was that the first skirmish of the rent wars?
It's the beginning because it suggests that there's a lot of animosity between landlords and tenants. The issue there is that there's a shortage of coal and the apartments are not being properly heated and lit. And also commercial buildings, but it sort of presages that the tenants are prepared to take things into their own hands, not simply if they're not getting heat, but also if the landlords are raising the rent.
Were most landlords withholding the coal because they were unwilling to pay the high prices for coal? Was there a war going on with
the tenants?
That's
what the tenants are claiming. I think probably there was a terrible coal shortage. And even landlords who were trying to do the right thing couldn't get coal. It was one of the most bitter winters in American history. It was hard to get coal from the mines. And then when they got them to New Jersey, where it ended up, the harbor was frozen.
But leases generally cover heat and hot water, don't they? Although there were cold water flats. There's still a cold water flats in New York.
That's a big argument between the tenants and landlords as to whether the landlord is obliged contractually to provide heat and hot water. The courts seem to think that the landlords were so obliged, but their argument was that we can't get coal. There isn't coal to buy. That creates a lot of animosity, which will then grow much worse when, after the war, the landlords steadily and sharply jack up the rents, sometimes as much as 6-7 times a year.
Was this happening all over the city?
Richmond or Staten Island, as you know, is not quite part of New York, and not very many people live in Queens at that time. It is all over Manhattan, Brooklyn, and the Bronx. And interestingly, it is not just working-class neighborhoods. A lot of middle and upper-middle-class folks are getting very sharp rent increases and are very agitated, as much as working-class people.
But the socialists played a role in agitating this.
A very big role, because the socialists begin to see that the rising rents are tailor-made as a campaign issue. The Socialist Party is at its heyday at the time that this takes place. They run very strongly on the issue of they call for public housing, they call for rent control, and both Tammany Hall and the Republicans are very, very concerned that the socialists will make political capital out of the rent issue.
Well, what were judges deciding? Were they siding with the tenants or with the landlords?
Well, it's a terrific question, but it's very complicated. Before the emergency rent laws, the legal system is very much in favor of the landlords. The tenants are in a very vulnerable position. Some judges tried to make it easier for them, but if the tenants are unwilling to pay the rent, the landlords go to court, ask for a final order, and asking the court to say either pay your rent or move out. Some judges try to make it easier, but they have very little discretion. Once the emergency rent laws go into effect, it creates what we know now today as statutory tenants. It means that you're allowed to stay in your apartment, not by virtue of your lease, but by virtue of a statute, even after your lease expires, as long as you're prepared to pay what the court deems is a reasonable rent.
I'm assuming there was a huge backlog in the courts.
Courts were jammed beyond belief because the landlords would bring the tenants to court asking for a final order, and if they got it, asking for an eviction warrant. The tenants would refuse on the grounds that they were statutory tenants and they were protected by the rent laws. And what the landlord was doing was asking for an unreasonable rent. And then the poor municipal court judges have to figure out what's a reasonable rent when the statute doesn't say what a reasonable rent is and doesn't provide any criteria for it. The judges are at a loss.
My guest is Robert M. Fogelson, who's a professor of urban studies and history at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, author of several books. The one that brought him to our show last was Downtown. This one is called The Great Rent Wars, New York, 1917-1929. It's published by Yale University Press, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Professor Robert M. Fogelson. His latest book, The Great Rent Wars, New York, 1917-1929, published by Yale University Press. I've been informed that the vacancy rate in New York right now is 1.6%, and some realtors have it even lower at 1.38%. So we're kind of close to what it was like during the time of your book. But you mentioned that it came as a bit of a surprise that that state legislature, which was dominated by upstate Republicans, would enact these new laws. Wasn't it also because they feared that if they didn't, the Socialist Party would gain more support?
That was definitely one of the fears. The other thing was that there were serious problems like in New York's in Buffalo, Rochester, and other big cities. And there was pressure from tenant groups there to have some action taken. To further complicate matters, the problem was that there wasn't enough housing being built. The legislature thought about various efforts to get more housing built, but none of them got off the ground, including the one for public housing. That was too radical for the state legislature, even though people like Congressman LaGuardia and Borough President Curran wanted public housing, the legislature wouldn't do it. So if they were unable to control the supply of housing, if there was nothing they could do to restart residential construction, the only thing that they could think of was to revise landlord-tenant law.
Now, Governor Al Smith was very much the New Yorker, downtown Manhattanite. Did he hold much sway with the upstate legislators?
There's a short period when the Democrats control the Senate. Smith signed these laws. Smith was governor for all but 2 years. A Republican, Miller, came in for 2 years. He was generally supportive of the rent laws and of the extension of the rent laws because they were extended after the 2 years ran out. They extended for 2 more years and 2 more years, then for 1 year and 1 year before they were finally allowed to expire. But Smith was not a very strong advocate of rent control. Smith was more concerned with finding ways to get housing built, subsidizing private enterprise, providing tax abatements for private enterprise. And he would have been content, I think, with some form of public housing, but there was too much opposition.
Is this where Robert Moses comes into the story?
No, Moses is not in this story. Moses has got other things on his mind at this time, though he's one of the many bright young men and women who flock to Smith's camp. But he's not involved in the story, no.
When the emergency rent laws were set to expire completely in 1929, was there much political will to extend them?
It's also an interesting question. The state legislature decides in 28 that the laws, which are left at that point, are only in New York and Buffalo, will expire in June 1st, 29. That's the major laws. There are several other minor laws which stay in effect indefinitely. There is some resistance to this, especially in Harlem and other low-income neighborhoods, where the tenants take the position that the emergency may be over for the well-to-do, but it's definitely not over for the poor. And they've been making that argument throughout the 20s. There's so much pressure that the New York City Council enacts an ordinance which creates a new rent control law for the city. But it's essentially a sham, because most everybody understands that the city does not have the authority to impose rent control. This is only the state legislature does. And sure enough, within a month or two after the city law is enacted, lawsuits are filed, and the city laws are held unconstitutional. And that trial court's decision is not appealed, and then those laws are gone too.
Well, then we get the Great Depression.
Yeah.
And there are a lot more poor people at this point. Is housing stock still very limited?
Well, there are more poor people, and there are a lot of people, especially in places like Harlem, where there are rent strikes in the 30s. But on the other hand, the landlords can't raise the rent because the tenants can't pay the rent. So the rent issue becomes less of an issue at that point in time, though a lot of people can't even... It's not that the landlords are charging unreasonable rents in the 30s. It's that people just don't have money.
So they kept the rents down.
The rents were held down.
And then that all changes after World War II?
Yes.
Or during World War II, when inflation suddenly rears its ugly head again?
Well, it does, but the rents are controlled under the OPA-sponsored rent control laws in the 40s, which... expire in most cities. New York is the one great conspicuous exception, and they go on to the present. But that's a book about the second round of rent control that I definitely don't want to write.
Well, you end this book just before the stock market crash that sets off the Great Depression. Yeah. I'm assuming that during the Depression there was very little housing stock built.
Yes, very little of anything built, commercial or residential. But I was very happy to be able to. This book is, as you know, it's a 500-page book, and it only goes from 1917 to 29, though for a lot of issues I have to go back further in time. But I don't bring it up to date.
Well, can we bring it up to date just a little bit?
You can, but there's a fair chance I won't know the answers.
Well, I'm wondering, in 1943, when rent control is proposed once again, whether people were citing the earlier laws and saying, well, they were a success, and let's do this again.
I don't know. What I do know is something that is, I think, great interest, is that one of the most striking features of the period I study is that when the state legislature imposes rent control, it doesn't do what public authorities virtually always do when they try to regulate private enterprise, which is they set up a bureaucratic organization. An Interstate Commerce Commission to regulate interstate commerce, a Public Utility Commission to regulate public utilities. They don't set up anything. They leave the implementation of the emergency rent laws entirely up to the municipal court judges, or if the cases are appealed, to the higher court judges. That changed in the 40s. And when rent control came back to New York, one of the things that was set up was an agency to administer it, which still exists. And I suspect, though I've never done research on this, I expect that they understood the enormous complications that came from leaving it entirely up to some 50 different municipal court judges to figure out what a reasonable rent was. That's a whole chapter. To figure out who was covered by the rent laws, which was very complicated, and to figure out the exceptions to the rent laws, like, just to give one example, a landlord could evict someone who was willing to pay a rent because they were undesirable tenants. So the landlord would charge that they were undesirable tenants, but it would all have to go to court because the tenant would say, I'm not undesirable. He just wants to throw me out so he can bring in someone who'll pay a higher rent.
Well, that's still the case, isn't
yes,
it?
That hasn't gone away.
And the legislature, did anybody argue that the word reasonable was going to cause trouble? I'm thinking later when we have desegregation and it's in all due speed or whatever.
Deliberate speed.
Deliberate speed. One person's idea of deliberate speed, one person's idea of reasonable is totally different from the next.
One idea of who's desirable, who's undesirable. The landlords could also reclaim their property if they said they wanted the apartment for themselves or their immediate family. So the landlords start claiming they want the apartment for themselves and their family. The tenant goes to court and says, no, no, he wants to throw me out and bring someone else in who'll pay a higher rent. The judges are overwhelmed with these kinds of issues.
And one of the things that's striking about your book is just how much depended on the courts.
Absolutely.
Did that put a lot of political pressure on the judges who were hearing this tidal wave of cases that the rent wars were creating?
Very, very controversial. There are some municipal court judges who were deemed tenant judges, and there are some who were deemed landlord judges.
Well, they were often appointed by politicians.
No, they're elected.
Oh, they are elected?
These 10-year terms. And there are some who very, especially William Morris, who distinctly side with the tenants and says he's not going to evict anyone. He's going to prevent landlords from raising rents. And there are some who are more sympathetic to the landlords.
Were evictions common?
Evictions were very common before the emergency rent laws. But once the emergency rent laws are passed, evictions are very rare because you have to – the only way you can evict someone then is if someone refuses to pay a reasonable rent or they can prove to the court that they're undesirable or that the landlord wants the apartment for himself.
And undesirable would be somebody who causes trouble, who makes a lot of noise, who has a criminal record.
Yeah, who makes booze in the apartment. Or in one case, the landlord said the guy kept 16 dogs in his apartment. The courts are also important because there are two chapters in the book about the constitutionality of rent control. There's one whole set of cases that comes up in the state courts, ends up in the Court of Appeals, which by a sweeping 6-1 decision holds that the rent laws are a valid exercise of the police power. It's a very strong decision. The tenants are delighted. But then another case goes to the federal court, ends up in the U.S. Supreme Court, which on a 5-4 vote, with Oliver Wendell Holmes writing the majority decision, that court holds that, yes, the laws are valid, but not as an exercise of the police power, but only in the event there's still an emergency. And that's a very narrow decision, which means eventually the laws are going to expire, and they expire in Washington, and then later the legislature lets them expire in New York.
Well, the emergency rent laws put the onus of proof on the landlords, didn't they?
Yes, yes.
So the landlords were hiring lawyers. This must have been a good time for both landlord and tenant lawyers.
The lawyers are very busy. They're busy on constitutional issues. They're busy on all the local issues about the arguments over who is covered, over what's a reasonable rent, and whether any of these four exceptions apply. Landlords are very, very busy.
And there's a lot of course, landlords hated these laws. But rent control wasn't totally eliminated. It gave way to rent stabilization.
That's after World War II. Yes. That, I regret to say, I know very little about.
Well, we had a mayoral race not all that long ago in which Jimmy McMillan made a big splash by being the candidate of the Rent is Too Damn High party. Nothing like that at the time. It was the socialists were the Rent is Too Damn High party.
Well, the socialists, and then there are also a lot of tenant leagues, some of which are affiliated with the Socialist Party, others of which are not. There are tenant groups in buildings, on blocks, in neighborhoods, in boroughs, and then there's a citywide tenants organization.
So who signed these laws into effect? The Ball Act, for example. What president?
The Ball Act is under Wilson, mm-hmm. and it's passed by Congress. It's the second rent control act from Congress, the first of which, the Salisbury Resolution, is struck down by the courts. The Ball Rent Act, which goes to the U.S. Supreme Court at the same time that the emergency rent laws go, that was upheld, but that had been struck down by the D.C. appellate courts. So the U.S. Supreme Court has got the district court, the federal district court, upholding the rent laws in New York, the District of Columbia Appellate Court striking down the rent laws. And so the Supreme Court has virtually no choice but to hear the case and to uphold both sets of rent laws by this very narrow 5-4 vote.
Well, New York was largely a liberal city even then. Even LaGuardia being a Republican, he was about the most liberal Republican.
Yes.
Today, he would have lost definitely in his primary race against some Tea Party candidate. After Woodrow Wilson, we have Coolidge and then
Harding and then
Harding
Coolidge.
And the two conservative presidents, and then Hoover.
Well, history is very strange. Coolidge, who was quite conservative, was actually a supporter of rent control in Washington, D.C., something that surprised me greatly. I didn't look all that close. I had to look at the Washington story because the Washington law and the New York law come to the Supreme Court together.
And you've looked at the dissents, I imagine.
A very, very bitter dissent written by Joseph McKenna. McKenna is livid. He thinks that Holmes has got everything wrong. He thinks these laws violate due process, the due process clause, the contract clause, and other clauses of both federal and state constitutions, though he's mainly concerned with it. His dissent is longer than Holmes' majority opinion. The opinions are written largely on the basis of the Washington, D.C. thing, and then they're applied to the New York. But McKenna is just furious. But Holmes, I think on his own, Holmes might have called these decisions a valid exercise of the police power, but he probably couldn't have crafted a majority, and that's why he writes a much narrower decision, and he gets four of his colleagues to go along with him.
But we're mainly talking about New York and Washington. There weren't similar problems in other large cities like Chicago, Los Angeles, Boston.
There's a controversy in Chicago.
Philadelphia.
There's a controversy in Los Angeles and Boston, Philadelphia. I don't recall. But the housing shortage is a problem that struck most of big American cities. New York is special because it is a tenant city. It has the largest percentage of the residents, or a larger percentage of the residents are tenants in New York than anywhere else. So it becomes a very big issue. It's not a trivial issue in Boston or in Chicago, but it's not. Rent control nowhere as it's controversial, and nowhere does it last as long as in New York, where it lasts for an entire decade.
And New York remains a renter's city, but there are some of the big fights today are over whether new construction should destroy buildings that have given New York a lot of its character.
Yeah.
Exactly. They weren't fighting over that at the time?
Not at the
time. Well, actually, everybody wants to be in a pre-war building, so the buildings that are involved here are the ones that people would love to be in today.
Well, despite the claims of the real estate interest, the rent control does not stop the great surge of construction in the 20s because new construction was exempt from all these laws. And there is the greatest surge, I guess, of any time before the Depression, from about 22 to about 26 or 7. There's a huge building boom in New York City, which doesn't stop until around 29. So the real estate interests claim that these rent laws would stop construction, but that didn't happen. The tenants said that it would keep the rents down and equalize things. That didn't happen so much either because landlords found ways to get around the rent control laws. And it also meant if you moved, sometimes you would lose the protection of the laws. So they were neither as good as the tenants had hoped or as bad as the landlords had feared.
Robert M. Fogelson is professor of urban studies and history at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, author of several books, including most recently Downtown, Its Rise and Fall, 1880 to 1930. Also, Bourgeois Nightmares, Suburbia, 1870 to 1930. And now, The Great Rent Wars, New York, 1917-1929, all published by Yale University Press. Are you ever going to get past 1933 in any of your books?
Yes. This is also a good question. I am now writing a book about the demise of the movement for nonprofit limited equity cooperative housing in New York City.
Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me. It's always nice to be in New York, and it's nice to talk with you.